Here you are. And it's just about 6 o'clock. You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM. And that's your sponsor, radio station. And I said, stay tuned, coming up next, the 6 o'clock news.
Wish I'd forget you. Oh, but you're here to stay.
Now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, March 20th. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. In tonight's news, the Trump administration is dismantling a small agency that helped fund 18 Wisconsin museums and libraries last year.
A new report finds that international migration has surged in Wisconsin over the last 3 years.
An Alder candidate wants to consolidate city and county housing services.
And in the second half, Out of the Box shares a redemption story. The House Always Wins has some house hunting advice. And Radio Chipstone gets nostalgic.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Turkey's president has sought to downplay public demonstrations taking place following the detention of the mayor of Istanbul. Ekrem İmamoğlu, the main rival to Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was arrested days before he was expected to be named the candidate for the 2028 presidential election. Mr. Erdogan accused the main opposition party of seeking to distract from its own failures. Emily Wither reports from Istanbul.
Protesters clashed with police for a second night as the leader of the opposition, Özgür Özel, addressed the crowds, telling them the streets are ours, the squares are ours. This was a clear call for people to come out and demonstrate against the arrest of İmamoğlu. A government appointee is expected to take over the Istanbul mayor's office in the coming days. But Özel has said his party will resist leaving Istanbul's municipality building. He's also made an international plea for help and said the EU should not sacrifice Turkey's democracy.
President Trump has signed an executive order to dismantle the US Department of Education, vowing to return the money it controls to individual states. Mr. Trump accused the department of breathtaking failures. Democrats called the planned closure reckless. From Washington, Gary O'Donoghue.
Getting rid of the Department of Education has been a long-standing aim for Republicans, and many conservative voters will enthusiastically support this move. America does badly in many international league tables in terms of educational outcomes, and Republicans blame the department for that, despite the fact that individual states already control almost 90% of the money that educates children in US schools. Where the federal government does have sway is in the provision of support for low-income and disabled children. The president says those programs will still be supported, but administered by other agencies.
The health ministry in Gaza says more than 90 Palestinians have been killed on the third day of the renewed Israeli offensive. This brings the death toll to almost 600 since Tuesday. John Donison reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's military issued a fresh evacuation order across much of the strip as it expanded its offensive. It dropped leaflets in residential areas, telling people to move to so-called safe areas or even to leave Gaza. Up until now, Hamas has not responded militarily to Israel breaking the ceasefire. That changed this afternoon when it sent 3 rockets into Israel.
President Zelensky has asked European Union leaders for $5.5 billion for artillery shells to use in Ukraine's fight against Russia. He was addressing a security meeting in Brussels. The EU's foreign policy chief backed the call. BBC News. The family of a Boeing whistleblower who took his own life in the US state of South Carolina has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the aerospace giant. The complaint alleges that John Barnett was subjected to a campaign of harassment, abuse, and humiliation after raising concerns about safety issues. He was found dead in his car a year ago in Charleston, where he was due to give evidence against Boeing. The company hasn't commented on the lawsuit. France has expressed concern after border agents prevented a French researcher from entering the US because his smartphone contained messages criticizing President Trump. The French Minister for Higher Education said border agents searched the scientist's phone and laptop when he arrived to attend a conference earlier this month. The former Olympic swimming champion Kirsty Coventry of Zimbabwe has become the first woman and first African to be elected president of the International Olympic Committee. Speaking to the BBC, she thanked the strong female role models in her life.
I'm grateful for the support that I've had, and especially to all the women that have been in my life, strong leaders, my grandmother, my mum, my coach. You know, I had really good examples of being able to go after everything. So I'm very lucky to have had that.
Oxygen has been found in the most distant galaxy ever discovered, providing further evidence that the universe developed much faster after the Big Bang than previously thought. The galaxy's light took more than 13 billion years to reach Earth, meaning it can reveal what the universe was like when it was just 300 million years old. It had been believed the universe at that age was still too young to contain heavy elements such as oxygen. BBC News.
This is Marcus Slayton and Christina Leffering with your local news coming to you from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. The measure Congress passed last week to avert a government shutdown excluded $250 million in funding for public projects in Wisconsin, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The projects include a new sewage treatment plant for Prairie du Chien, National Guard Readiness Centers in Wausau and Wisconsin Rapids, and a rural clinic in Sauk County. Senator Tammy Baldwin advocated for research grants to the University of Wisconsin, UW-Milwaukee, and Marquette Universities. That money was also removed. The budget extension will maintain basic government operations for 1 year.
Federal transportation funds already allocated to the state are being unlawfully withheld and should be distributed immediately, Governor Tony Evers wrote in a letter to Trump administration Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. Money overdue to Wisconsin includes $78 million intended to build a network of charging stations for electric vehicles, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. When Trump took office, he issued executive orders halting distribution of funds across a range of programs. Much of the money is actually repayment to the states for expenses they incurred while complying with the federal highway program.
A series of Republican-sponsored bills targeting transgender people passed today in the state assembly, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Assembly Bill 100 will require that all sports teams in public and private K-12 schools be divided by sex. Only one Democrat, Russell Goodwin of Milwaukee, joined all Republicans in voting for the measure. Bill 102 sets the same requirements for athletics in public universities and technical schools. That passed along party lines 50-43. Assembly Bill 103, which also passed along party lines, will require school boards to prohibit teachers from identifying a student by a name or pronoun that does not align with their assigned gender at birth. And AB 104, which will prohibit gender-affirming medical procedures for anyone under 18, also passed on a one-party line vote. Governor Tony Evers has vetoed similar bills in the past.
An economic justice measure that has failed to advance in two prior sessions of the Wisconsin legislature made its return to the state capitol today. The Economic Justice Bill of Rights was reintroduced by Madison Democrat Francesca Hong in the Assembly and Senate Democrat Chris Larson of Milwaukee and Jeff Smith of Brunswick. The legislation seeks to address the social, economic, and political issues that have affected communities across Wisconsin. Originally introduced in the 2021-22 legislative session, the measure outlines 10 conditions the lawmakers see as essential for a just and equitable future. They include access to dignified, well-paying jobs, fully funded public schools and childcare, the right to a union and collective bargaining, affordable comprehensive health care, a fair legal system, a sustainable environment, safe and affordable housing, transportation, and broadband, equitable access to capital, restorative justice, and freedom to participate fully in civic life.
The incumbent alder for Southside Madison District failed to gain endorsement from the County Democratic Party this election because he did not back the censure of another alder, reports the Capital Times. The Dane Dems, meanwhile, endorsed Alder Isidore Knox challenger in the 14th District, Democratic activist Noah Lieberman. At issue is Knox's refusal to go along with the censure of Alder Charles Miazzi, the alder representing District 18 on the north side. Several women accused Miazzi of acting violently towards them, and he was criminally charged following the city council's censure motion. Only Knox and Miazzi, who is not seeking re-election, voted against the censure.
A leading member of the Dane County Board announced yesterday that she will resign her position because soaring rents in her downtown district are forcing her to move. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Supervisor Elizabeth Doyle plans to move to the southeast side near Monona. She said rents in her downtown high-rise have risen by $2,400 over the last two lease cycles. Doyle has led two key county board committees since she was elected in 2019. From 2020 to 2022, she chaired the Health and Human Needs Committee, which oversees county human services. And since 2022, she has led the Personnel and Finance Committee, which oversees the county budget and staffing.
Madison's effort to encourage public transit and pedestrian safety seems to have eased traffic on some major city streets, but pressure on the Beltline has grown over the past 5 years, the Wisconsin State Journal reports. An annual report on the city's transit system shows the number of vehicles on East Washington Avenue, Monroe Street, South Midvale Boulevard, South Park Street, and Atwood Avenue fell 21% to about 102,000 cars and trucks per weekday between 2019 and 2024. On the Beltline, which added a flex lane in 2022, traffic rose 6.5% during the same period. On a positive note, the number of pedestrian fatalities fell to 11 in 2024 when compared to 16 annually in the previous 4 years.
A leaking natural gas line ruptured in a vehicle collision, resulting in the closure of Packers Avenue for more than an hour this morning, reports the State Journal. Firefighters responded to 2334 Pennsylvania Avenue after the crash around 8 a.m. The public was asked to avoid the nearby 2300 block of Packers Avenue until about 9:15 a.m. as emergency crews worked to stem the leak. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
The Institute of Museum and Library Services helps support cultural and educational institutions in all 50 states. Last year alone, the small federal agency helped fund libraries and museums of all types across Wisconsin. Now it's being dismantled. WRT reporter Maria Segura has more of what it means for Madison.
The Institute of Museum and Library Services is the latest agency to be targeted by the Trump administration. Last Friday, Trump issued an executive order calling for the dismantling of the IMLS, along with half a dozen other cultural agencies. Now, groups supported by IMLS funding are sounding the alarm.
We started talking with colleagues at Madison Public Library about doing some joint advocacy together. We reached out to the children's museums around the state of Wisconsin. We created some messaging templates, because we serve children, we've set up a postcard writing station at our museum, so families can fill out postcards that are addressed to Senator Baldwin, Senator Johnson, and also people can find their state legislator's address and do some civic engagement by writing on behalf of museums and libraries. And we very much are in this together with all of our beloved public libraries across the country.
That's Kia Carlin, Vice President of Education and Community Engagement at the Madison Children's Museum, which in fiscal year 2024 received $250,000 from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. The grant helped the museum in external community engagement efforts, along with long-range strategic planning. Carlin says without the money,
museums are going to have to rethink our funding streams. We'll probably rely more heavily on individual giving. We'll have to look at our earned revenue capacities.
The Children's Museum is one of 18 museums and libraries in Wisconsin that got funding from the Institute of Museum and Library Services last year. The others include nearly $500,000 distributed to 7 tribal nations, over $350,000 to UW-Madison's Information School, and more than $3.2 million to Wisconsin's library systems, which support individual branches throughout the state.
The Department of Public Instruction in Wisconsin has a division for library service, and that is funded almost exclusively with IMLS funds. So they support a wide variety of things, from continuing education to underpinning some of the technology that happens in libraries to a wide variety of different consulting services.
That's Tana Elias, director of the Madison Public Library. She tells WORT that unlike city funding, IMLS grants lets libraries try new and innovative programs.
We've had multiple IMLS grants at Madison Public Library, which have really revolutionized either the way we track programs, the Bubbler program, which is our arts maker-based program that was, you know, that we started in 2013, was started with an IMLS National Leadership Grant, and has become a national model for that kind of interactive, collaborative, hands-on art-making program.
Other changes at the small federal agency are also afoot. IMLS Deputy Director Laura Huerta Miguez has been dismissed from her position. And just today, Deputy Secretary of Labor Keith Sunderling was sworn in as the acting director of the IMLS in a release. Sunderling said he was committed to steer the agency in lockstep with Trump administration, and particularly their goal to, quote, enhance efficiency and foster innovation, unquote. The IMLS makes up 0.0046% of the overall federal budget. Both the Children's Museum and Public Library are calling on residents to contact Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson to stop the dismantling of the IMLS and preserve access to libraries and museums. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Maria Segura.
After years of below-average growth, international migration has surged in Wisconsin for the last 3 years. With the new administration and a crackdown at our borders, that is likely to change. What will that mean for the state economy and our quality of life? Here's WORT reporter David Ahrens.
The millions of people who crossed our southern border between 2022 and 2024 did not stay in the border states. Many traveled north, including about 70,000 who moved to Wisconsin. According to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, these migrants helped the state overcome the decline in what is called natural growth, the number of births minus the number of deaths. And importantly, the tens of thousands of new residents helped sustain economic growth. Due to a declining birth rate and the increasing number of deaths of baby boomers, the natural growth in population each year in Wisconsin fell from about 25,000 15 years ago to little or no growth in the past few years. Without international and domestic migration, the state would have had little or no growth in the last 2 years. However, the state grew by 57,000 people, or 1%. That was a bigger increase than the other Midwestern states. I asked Mark Sommerhauser, the author of the report, what drove this change.
So I think it's a combination of we saw, you know, a solid influx of international migration, but we actually did see domestic in-migration during this period, whereas some of these other Midwestern states saw the opposite.
Of course, the new migrants did not settle equally across the state. Dane County had the biggest increase in population at 3%. How many of the new 17,000 county residents are international or domestic migrants, we don't know. The new migrants came to the state to work and jobs were available. In fact, the number of people entering the workforce, 30,000, was identical to the number of migrants, both domestic and international, that came to the state. But what will happen when the spigot is cut off? At its peak in 2023, an estimated 3.3 million people migrated to the U.S., including refugees from the Ukraine and Venezuela. This year, less than 200,000 migrants are expected. The current administration also intends to deport many times that number. Sommerhauser noted,
and, you know, the rhetoric that we've heard from the new administration, that there's going to be a lot of efforts to restrict international migration. You know, that combined with the fact that we were seeing record levels for those last few years. So that as well seems to suggest that it's unlikely to increase further from that level and probably much more likely to decrease.
It's estimated that currently there are only 6 to 7 workers available for every 10 job vacancies in Wisconsin. Sommerhauser, one of the authors of the report, says that a state population decline would result from big reductions in international migration and the falling rate of natural growth. This could result in negative economic and social effects. He said,
we know that there are industries already, even with our state's population growing, we know that there are a number of industries where there aren't enough qualified workers, areas such as healthcare, for instance, that if we tip over into a full population decline scenario, those types of labor shortages are only likely to worsen. That combined with, kind of an aging population, a greater need for some services, certainly healthcare services, could be a problematic combination in terms of, ensuring that people have access to healthcare.
This is David Ahrens for WORT News.
Sean Burke, a freelance marketing specialist, made an unsuccessful bid last year for Dane County Board of Supervisors. Now he's challenging incumbent Northside Alder Sabrina Madison for her seat on the city council. Theirs is the most contentious race this spring. Burke tells our news producer Faye Parks that the city and county need to work together to solve the housing crisis.
Hi, I'm Sean Burke, and I am running for Alder District 17 in the city of Madison. I'm currently a freelance marketing specialist, and I have lived in Madison most of my adult life since I attended boarding school here in Madison in my high school years. And I have run for previous office. Last year, I ran for Dane County Board of Supervisors in District 12. My leadership style is, first and foremost, listening to the people of District 17. I think those are the people I work for. And then I convey those thoughts to the members of the Common Council. I am an independent candidate who is there for the people. I'm not beholden to the whims and will of the mayor. I tend to try to build consensus, but I also believe that there needs to be a lot more compromise on the Common Council. Currently, we seem to have more of a very select group of people that seem to dominate the Common Council, and their opinions and policies seem to rule, and they just don't work for everybody.
So it's my understanding that you joined this race sort of at the last minute. Your filings came in at the last minute. You touched on that just now, but I'm wondering if you could speak more on what inspired you to run for city council this spring.
Last time when I ran for Dane County Board, there were only 10 races out of 37 board members, which means 27 districts were basically unopposed. And that's not giving people a choice. And in a thriving and healthy democracy, people need to have an option other than just one. And I think that the people in District 17 know where I stand on the issues. I think they know who I am as a person. And they realize that having a second option is a good thing. I got into this race because I think that the people deserve a choice. And my opponent was essentially appointed to the Common Council and then has run unopposed since. And I just think it's good for people to have a choice.
Could you tell me what is one specific achievement that you would want to drive forward in city government if elected?
One of my primary goals as the only candidate on the ballot who's currently unhoused is to really get the city and the county to work together to solve the housing crisis, because the way housing is attacked in Dane County is you have the county and the city and there's really no coordination and there's a lot of overlap. And for people to get services, you almost need a PhD, and it's insane. One of my goals is to streamline that process and make things more effective for the people so that they can get into housing with fewer bureaucratic barriers. I believe that the housing services of Dane County and the City of Madison need to be merged, very similar to what we did with public health. Some of the barriers are one program is run by the city, one's run by the county, and you need to figure out how do you qualify for each one. And it becomes very taxing on people, especially when the county and the city are going through nonprofit partners. You're just going through an endless flow of different people, and the process needs to be brought in-house more so that there's more oversight and more control over how people are getting services and getting services to the people quicker.
So I'd like to speak more on housing generally, as it's perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or about $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
Everybody needs to be brought to the table and figure this out. Mayor, Common Council, County Executive, County Board, but the unhoused need to have a voice. They're the ones that haven't had a voice for a long time, and that's part of the problem is that just nobody's listening to the people who need the help the most. I think we need to address low-income housing for people that are disabled, veterans, or people that are just going through substance or drug abuse treatment who need just that one good step. We need to have more projects that offer reasonable low-income housing and affordable housing, but also offer green space and a space for community, because just having apartment buildings with parking lots is not a good answer. Where we can go just a step further is actually helping those developers find people to rent those properties. There are people living in hotels long-term that could benefit from just a simple outreach of somebody bringing a laptop to the hotel and helping them apply. It's just something as simple as that.
So I'm going to pivot slightly here to talk about the city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. It was an unusual choice for voters, but they ultimately approved it. City finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
I was against the referendum because people are getting taxed out of their homes. That's one thing I learned when I ran for county board is seniors especially are one or two or maybe three tax increases away from losing their houses. I think that the city spends a lot of money on nonprofit services that could be done in-house. I think that those, when you tack on administrative fees and all the overheads you're paying, if you're paying that over multiple agencies, that gets really expensive. That's money that could go into direct services. That's one priority we should look at.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents in their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
The people of District 17 are my bosses. If it is something that they don't feel is good, I will make sure that their voices are heard. However, I do also have to weigh what is good for everybody as a whole. And the one thing about me that people know is that I'm a straight talker. I'm not going to lie to the people of District 17. I'm going to take their input and give them my perspective and say how this is good for everybody in general. Hopefully, by having a robust debate with my colleagues on the council, we can find a compromise that might not appease everybody in District 17, but might make their concerns a little less alarming and still benefit the city as a whole.
What exactly has been the tenor of this spring's campaign between yourself and the incumbent Alder Sabrina Madison?
Unfortunately, my opponent has turned this into a more personal attack campaign than actually wanting to discuss issues. So for that, I am sad for the people of District 17. Alder Madison opted within an hour of me filing to go on social media and viciously attack me, making false and fraudulent accusations against me. I have received nonstop harassment phone calls and just downright death threats. I have reached out to Alder Madison regarding help with my housing. because I was back and forth between city and county. And that goes back to everyone who's looking for housing. They get batted between housing with county officials, city officials, back and forth, back and forth. This allegation that I attack women in power, that is completely false. That is absolutely false. So this misinformation, these outright lies by Alder Madison are unfortunate. And I really wish that she could have started this campaign on a much more positive note. But again, she decided to take this into the mud immediately and engage in MAGA style attacks against me. And that's just unfortunate. But I think the people of District 17 know that I am a good person. I'm just like them. I have common sense approach to everything. And like I said, I want to listen to them because they're ultimately the people who I work for.
That was an excerpt of our full interview with City Council candidate Sean Burke. You can access the rest on our website, wortfm.org. As of this broadcast, Burke doesn't have a campaign website and is instead directing folks to his profile on Ballotpedia.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News here on WORT. Please stay with us. We've got lots more stories coming up.
Out of the Box shares a redemption story, The House Always Wins has some house hunting advice, and Radio Chipstone gets nostalgic.
But first, we'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to wortfm.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
Justin Yap is the founder of Yapography, a video production and digital media consulting firm based here in Madison. Sitting down with Out of the Box host D Star, Yap shares how he turned his life around after a lengthy stay in the Columbia County Jail.
So for the people that don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I've been in the video production industry now for 18 years, owned my own business for 12. A lot of self-taught stuff, hard, you know, especially with business, you know, the nuances that go into it, sales, making deals, you know, networking, that kind of stuff, something that you don't necessarily get taught very well in school, but that you learn quickly when you're actually in the grind of things. I got a family of two kids, wife, live in Sun Prairie.
Yeah, so where are you from?
Lodi, Wisconsin, a little town called Lodi, up by Lake Wisconsin.
So how was life growing up in Lodi?
It's a great little quaint town. Plenty of stuff to do in the summertime, wintertime. It's back then anyways, not much to do other than get into trouble. You know, being a small town, that we didn't have like a rec center or a lot of extra curriculum activities, unless you were like a sports nut athlete, which I am definitely not. Therefore, there was a void, you know, that gotta get filled somehow, right? Right. Mischief and mayhem was what kind of filled the void. Growing up, I had a pretty straightforward, you know, situation. Normal childhood for a while, but then when you get to the high school stage, you know, you're a teenager and your hormones are going through, you're going through puberty and like, you know, whatever, and there's not much to do. I got out of sports, got into drugs. I had very bad priorities set for myself as a young person.
So what was your first experience with drugs, and was it your decision? Well, of course, it's your decision, but
right.
Were you peer pressured into it, or is it something that you were curious about? What led you down that path?
I'd say alcohol led me down to that path. I first drank at age 12. So one of my buddy, Rusty, you know, we grew up just down the road from each other. His parents split up at an early age. His mom was a partier like from hell, man. Like we, you know, here we are young kids and she'd be having like house parties with us witnessing all this stuff. People be doing all kinds of drugs, street drugs. We were being exposed to this at very young ages. And we're like, wow, they're having a good time. You know, like these adults are laughing and having a good time. We should try some of that, right? And so me and Rusty, we'd always be sneaking things and going in and like trying to start off with the alcohol. Then it went to the weed and then, you know, cocaine, pills, and all that other stuff later on. But it started with alcohol. I'd say that's more of the gateway than weed is.
For you, like, you know, that was your slippery slope.
I'd say so. I think for most, though, because alcohol is so much more relatively available. I never looked at weed as the gateway for me anyways. It was... because alcohol led to weed and, you know, those two aren't that bad. Cocaine can't be bad, right?
Right.
Heroin can't be bad.
Right.
So that was the mindset I had.
So what led you to getting in trouble with the law?
Well, you know, like I said, snowballing into it. I started breaking and entering into summer cottages on Lake Wisconsin. You know, it's Illinois people would have properties up here. We'd target them. We'd know that they wouldn't be home, you know, during the winter months. And so we'd have the place to ourselves to, you know, just take our time. And mostly the electronics, you know, that kind of stuff you're taking that you can sell quickly on the street to get money to buy the next 8-ball or whatever it is that we're trying to get. And that's kind of what snowballed into a really, really bad decision-making path that I was on. Eventually, the law catches up, right? People start noticing things, start to be more aware because this is happening. And then somebody in our crew got pinched, spilled the beans, set me up to kind of come out of the house one day, called me up, said, hey, you want to go smoke? It was like 10 o'clock at night. Never would call me this late anyways. So I thought something was kind of off-putting, but me being a drug addict, oh, I can get high right now? Yeah, let's do it. I wasn't really going with my gut. Like something wasn't right with the phone call. So she picked me up. We went down the street by about a block, turns left, and then starts to pull over. I'm like, what are you doing? She's like, there's cops. I'm like, what? And then the cherries and berries came on.
Right.
So she was responding before they were even pulling her over. I'm like, dude, what are you, what? What is going on here? I'm like, I was very confused. They came around the car to my side of the door and they said, Mr. Yap, can you please step out? I said, why? What's going on? You know, like we haven't done nothing wrong. And then they're like, well, we have reason to believe that you've been a part of, you know, a
theft. String of robberies,
blah, blah, blah. Let's take a look at your shoes. And they're, oh, that shoe looks like a match. They arrested me for questioning. They put me into the hole. And then from there, they just presented all their evidence on the spot there. And I was like, okay, you know, an awful lot. And so not coming from a privileged family, I had to get a public defender. His advice to me was to make a plea deal. And so I copped to the stuff that they knew about because they had evidence against me. And this was my lawyer's advice. And so I'm like, yeah, that was me. And ended up going to the county jail for 13 months. And just enough where they wouldn't send me to prison. They kept me in county jail, which is worse.
Which is worse.
Way worse. Back then in the 90s and 2000s, they were... There was an old saying, you come on vacation, leave on probation. That's true in Columbia County. And so they kept me in the damn county jail. And I got 8 years probation off of that, too.
What was your experience in jail for all of that time?
It was rough, man. So it was around Christmas when I first got arrested. So I sat that before my sentencing, you know. So I was in the county jail for a while, locked up before I even got my sentencing. That was through Christmas. And then by the time I got sentenced, I had another, you know, year to serve. And that was through another Christmas. So like Christmas Day was what really hit. I was looking around. I was like, just absolute despicable people around me. You know, like most people I would see come and go multiple times. I was like, this is the life that they have set for themselves, right? This is what they know. They don't seem to mind it, I guess. Like they keep coming back. And that's when I had the epiphany. I'm like, I don't want to have this ever happen again. Like this sucks.
What was your aha moment?
Christmas Day. The second Christmas. Yes.
The second Christmas. You like, this is the second Christmas.
This is the second Christmas. I'm missing out. Merry Christmas, right? Like this is the life I have set for myself if I continue down this path. Or death.
You get out, then what?
I have a new opportunity ahead of me, right? So I'm like, I'm presented with a crossroads. I go back to doing what I know. But at this point, I'm now a year clean. I went through all my withdrawals in jail. You know, the worst of the, it's already past me, right? All that, that's what made jail even worse, right? For the two months, I'm just detoxing and going through all this stuff. So that means I'm like, well, I'm not going to go back to using again. Like, that'd be stupid. So you kind of get a good perspective on who cares, who's been there, right? And your worst time, who showed up? Obviously family. And I had a few friends that still believed in me. Like one of my teachers, like to this day, I love her so much, Miss Dalton. So I had to graduate high school while in jail because that was my senior year I got arrested. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without her. She brought me my homework every Friday to the jail.
Wow.
Because she believed in me.
Shout out to her, man.
Yeah.
That's serious because that's something that she did not have to do.
Did not have to do it. And by all accounts, was what gave me more hope and gave me more like light at the end of the tunnel. There is something worth fighting for or working towards, right? Like she actually believes in me. She's telling me this by saying, hey, here you go. Get this homework done. I mean, granted, I'd have to read the textbooks.
Right. You have to do the work, yeah.
And I didn't have anybody to like, can you help answer this question right. for me? I had to figure it out all by myself.
Yeah.
And then hand the work in hoping that it was passable. So getting out, you know, I had things to hope for, right? I got my diploma. I started to look into college because I didn't know what else opportunities I had. I had a game plan for wanting to do photography at the time and video. So I knew I kind of wanted to do that because I always had a passion for it. And I had built blueprints for a dark room because you got to remember this is pre-digital age. This is all analog stuff still. You know, digital was coming out, but it was very new and expensive and not well known to me being incarcerated. When I got out, I had a blueprint to build a dark room.
So when did you go to college?
Pretty much right away. I had to find a job first, which that's another thing, man. Being a convicted felon, people just look at you like, why would I want to give you a what? No, I don't want you to be a part of my team.
Right.
So I don't know how our society expects people to better themselves when you're not given the opportunity to do so.
That was Justin Yap sitting down with host D-Star. You can listen to the rest of their conversation on the Out of the Box podcast.
Do you know when it's time to run away? In this archival edition of The House Always Wins, Allie and John tell you some red flags to watch for when house hunting.
I call it housework. Light work.
What you
I'ma throw shapes, filling the bass till my feet hurt. Hey! I call it housework.
Hello, I'm John.
And I'm Allie, and welcome to The House Always Wins, where you can learn cool stuff about your house.
We love cool stuff. You know, the blooming of spring flowers marks the beginning of house shopping season, and house shopping season in Dane County can get really competitive, with houses going on the market these days and getting multiple competing offers and offers on top of offers, sometimes within days and even hours.
Yeah, and so that can put a lot of pressure on a home shopper to take a quick look at a place, make an offer, and often give up their right to an inspection.
Oof.
And I've made offers on homes with less time and consideration than I've bought raincoats, basically.
Well, sure, but it was a really good raincoat, right? Oh, I mean,
100%.
It's my understanding that given higher interest rates, the market has cooled a bit since those crazy times of the last, I don't know, honestly, 3 years. We would always recommend having a home that you are planning to purchase inspected by a state-licensed home inspector. They can alert you to a wide range of home issues, and they can suggest which ones merit further investigation, and which items you need to take care of immediately, and which ones you could maybe let go, and which ones would be like, oh, heck no, we're not buying this house.
That's exactly what they do, and generally the price for a home inspection is under $1,000, so super worthwhile investment when we're talking about a $300,000-$400,000 purchase.
Right.
We thought it might be helpful to discuss which of those major issues that you might be able to observe on an initial walkthrough that should just lead you to turn tail and walk out of that house.
Well, you know, for me, one of the first ones that comes to mind is if you just drive up and you look at the roof and you see like scalloping of the shingles and maybe even some areas that might look like they might even have holes and maybe raccoons are moving in and starting a family, that oftentimes just from the street might be the first good clue of like driving away.
Right. Sometimes the animals are coming in from underneath the edge of the roof. It's the area we call the cornice, but the animals coming in there, boy, you got some problems. And the problem with seeing a little bit of rot is that there's always a lot more rot.
Yeah, isn't that like they say about in New York City? If you can see a couple of rats, there's another 100 friends that you can't see.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of like that, honestly, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's just showing up. You haven't even walked inside yet, right?
Yeah, exactly. So you don't even have to get out of the car. So that's nice for that.
Mm.
But let's say you walk in the house and, you know, one of the first things I would do is head down to the basement.
Right.
And most homes around here have basements.
It's
and
true.
Frankly, I know basements can be creepy.
Mm.
You got to be brave.
Got to be brave.
Uh-huh.
You can do it.
But you head down to the basement and a lot of times you can see that there's been some flooding issues and it's not super uncommon around here. There might be some stains on the wall and sort of roughly a horizontal line.
Right.
So that tells you sort of how high the water gets.
And if it's within 2 inches of the top of the foundation, it might be time to walk away.
For sure. You might see mold.
That's a bathtub.
Yeah, you might see mold. And honestly, if it's freshly painted, it's possible that they're trying to hide something.
That's always that's a red flag. If the basement is all freshly painted, what you trying to hide there?
Exactly. Sometimes there's even standing water. And there's a lot of reasons that basements might get wet. For example, a clogged floor drain could be the issue. So that's a simple repair by a Roto-Rooter type company and can be fixed for a few hundred dollars.
Right. So it may not be the killer thing, but also, you know, in my house is included in this. Some basements are just sitting below the level of the groundwater and it can lead to seasonal flooding, especially during the spring thaw. You know, the ground is letting all its moisture out. You get excess rain. That can lead to considerable flooding depending on the situation. That might be a home that just needs a drainage system and a sump pump to pump that all out of there. And granted, that's not cheap and it's definitely disruptive, but you could do it for $10,000 or less. It's definitely not the end of the world. They come in, they break up around the edges, they put in drain tile and a sump pit and the sump in. It's not bad. In fact, you had that done, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, and it worked brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, and I had it done in my rental property for, it was under $5,000 actually.
Wow.
I wouldn't call that runaway territory, but you'd want to address that. So when water, on the other hand, is coming in through large cracks in the floor or foundation, then you might start talking about larger dollar amounts, like well in excess of $10,000. And one of the realities is that when you have a large area of concrete, like you have a concrete floor or a foundation wall, they do tend to crack some.
They do.
Especially when they haven't been designed with expansion joints. Concrete will find its own way to create expansion joints.
Sure
it will
does.
Just crack. And so those types of cracks are often pretty small, less than a quarter inch wide. And you might see some of these types of cracks in the floor or coming off the corners of the basement windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not unusual. And if they're really small and thin and doesn't look like they're going past a couple feet long, you know, may not be too much to worry about. On the other hand, when those cracks are larger than a quarter inch or so, or when the two sides of the crack are clearly offset so there's movement, like significant movement in both the floor and the foundation, then you might want to start looking closer. And if the cracks are running horizontally, like you got a straight horizontal line and it's a block foundation, and it happens to be right about at, the ground level outside, that can be a big old red flag. And that is potentially a failing foundation. And the ground outside is soaking up moisture and putting all kinds of pressure on that block wall. And it's not going to stop putting that pressure on.
Yeah, and that can happen to a concrete wall, too.
It can.
And
it's
boy,
true.
Boy, howdy. That tells you that there's a failure going on in that foundation. Now we're talking about a very expensive repair.
Yeah, my first house, I did this. I went in with my eyes wide open. I knew what I was getting into. It was a block foundation, horizontal crack all the way across. But I had no overhangs, no gutters. So water was pouring off the roof, soaking up the soil, and it shoved it in so I could see it. And it was just one wall. So we got a great deal. I got $10,000 knocked off the price. And basically what I did is I evacuated the family one weekend and I excavated on the outside and I used 3 20-ton jacks and some luck and good wishes, and I cranked it and pushed the wall back to flat after grinding out the joints, and then I poured concrete columns on the outside with re-rod running the inside. It was complicated, and frankly, it's not a project for the typical homeowner.
It's not a project for me.
Well, I was in my 30s, and you're right. I don't think I would do that today. I'd be like, we'll go look at something else for sure.
Yeah.
But it was a big deal. And if you had to pay a contractor to do all that, that would be pretty expensive.
It's definitely five figures.
Oh, and, yeah.
In the upper five figures. So that's runaway territory.
It certainly is. Yeah. So it's funny. So it seems like we focus on the roof and the foundations. Everything in between, who knows? You know, those are some of the biggest issues we would probably say you need to definitely run away from. You know, there's other things. There could be electrical issues and plumbing issues that we probably just don't have time to get into today. Maybe we'll get into some of the other areas sometime soon in the future. But until then,
if you have a question about carpentry, home improvement, or what else?
Houses.
Okay. Until then, if you have a question about carpentry or home improvement, send us an email at thehousealwayswins@wortfm.org. But I'm going to throw shade if I don't get paid for this housework. I call it housework.
The time is now 6:49 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. Neil Brownsword is a historian, ceramic artist, and one of the first guests to appear on Radio Chipstone over a decade ago. In this archival episode, contributor Jennifer Fields takes you back to the beginning of this project.
When I produce segments about material culture, it's usually the object that drives the story. However, for ceramic artist Neil Brownsword, whose work is inspired by found objects, it's not only what you find, it's where you find it.
Place is so important, really. It's something I keep repeatedly going back to, and it's growing up in that place. And being surrounded by the history of that place is why it remains so important.
It's early evening in a lecture hall at UW-Madison. Students, professors, and artists are packed in, waiting for Brownsword to take the stage. He was born in Stoke-on-Kent in Staffordshire, England. If Staffordshire sounds familiar, it's because in the early 1800s, it was the epicenter of the pottery industry. It's the birthplace of Wedgwood china, famous for its blue and white ceramic ware.
As a child, you know, the woodland at the back of Mum and Dad's house, you know, were all those clay quarries, redundant ones, and I suppose it's, again, another initial contact with the material. You're there within these quite dangerous sites, which, again, kids always kind of hang around, don't they? And the kind of view, skyline view from home, it was all hills, holes, and factories. And a landscape carved by man, and the history of industry. So kind of slag heaps from the coal industry, not kind of hillsides, but kind of man-made mounds which had grassed over. So again, a connection to that kind of ugliness. And, you know, a fascination for it again, you know. Because it's slowly being kind of rebuilt over now. It's kind of its sense of kind of places being reclaimed, you know. Buildings are kind of taking over these sites, so it's in transition.
Brownsword grew up in a town built on pottery, literally.
I think you can't avoid the kind of material culture of that place because, like I said, most of that history is bedded in the ground because there was so much of it, you know, so you kind of expose, if there's a roadworks in one of the six towns in Stoke, inevitably where someone's dug up a pipe, you can see fragments of ceramics, you know, so that connection is immediately there, you know, the kind of sense of things being broken down and, you know, you can pick up a shard of what someone was making, you know, 100 years ago and get an immediate connection there and trace maybe the kind of fingerprints of labor from 100 years ago.
It's that kind of connection that drives his work. At the age of 16, he became an apprentice at the Wedgwood China factory. He watched as machines slowly replaced skilled workers. Unable to compete with large-scale industrialized operations, the small factories closed. It's the evidence of anonymous labor that once made the pottery factory great that inspires him. He says, while the brand name Wedgwood is known worldwide, the human labor behind it is often forgotten.
Thumbprints and fingernail prints, kind of clay is a wonderful material for, recording the memory of these actions, isn't it? You know, it's the kind of primordial material to, you squeeze it, it does whatever you want to, and all this stuff has got that kind of evidence of human contact in industry. The things what I find with that trace of labour in, I don't touch. So I keep that intact. It's really important. And even the scraps from the clay scraps from the factories, which I was salvaging, it was really important that I had no physical intervention with it other than stick it in the kiln and fire it to make it permanent. And then maybe glaze it to kind of lift the kind of beauty of some of these things.
Brown Sword says when he finds traditional trinkets, like the kind our grandmothers collect, he puts them back into the kiln to create new shapes. He says it's the excessive heat of the kiln that transforms them. One piece in his exhibition entitled Relic is a number of identical small white swans resting on a bent and twisted piece of metal. It's brutal, yet elegant. For one of his shows, he displayed the contents of a vacant factory. The abandoned equipment, workstations, and unfinished ceramic ware spoke volumes just as they were.
Most recent work is exactly that, because they are tools which are involved in the process, which were kind of stripped out of the factories and then crated up on pallets ready for kind of shipping off or scrapping. And my intervention is basically to take them and put them in a kind of gallery space. So it's really important that I have no physical contact with those things. It's just to display them as I've found them. I haven't transformed them in any way. They are the kind of the remnants of someone hand-painting a pot, so where they've kind of mixed a colour on a plate, or where a kind of blob of ink has been deposited through that process. It's really important for me to keep that intact and display them as I've found those things.
Brown Sword says it's important to leave the tools as he found them because they symbolize an immediate physical connection with work. They are the things potters used all day, every day. The careful preservation of deserted workstations destined to become scrap metal is a metaphor for laborers lost in the global industrial age. If you should find yourself warming your hands with tea in a delicate Wedgwood cup, remember, if not for the men and women whose labor created your beautiful bit of pottery, by now you'd have wet hands and a nasty burn.
Okay, thank you for coming. I'm Ethan Lasser from the Chipstone Foundation, and I'm happy to welcome Neil Brown Sword. I want to thank both the art department and Paul and Anna Andrzejewski, who I think is not feeling well today, and the Material Culture Program for bringing Neil out to Madison. Neil is a fascinating artist, really pleased to introduce him. He, at age 16, he started work at the Wedgwood Company, which everyone...
That was Neil Brownsword, a artist, researcher, and professor of digital tech innovation and business at the University of Staffordshire. He was also one of the first guests to appear on Radio Chipstone. Jennifer Fields is an art historian and material culture contributor and curates the Radio Chipstone series. She is also the host of Refrangible, available wherever you get your podcasts. The project is hosted by the School of Human Ecology and the Center for Design and Material Culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting our collective, their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
And that's a wrap for WORT's live local news at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporters this evening were Maria Segura and David Aarons. Special thanks to feature contributors D. Star, John Stephanie and Ali Bereni, and Jennifer Fields. Super Dave Lorenz engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Ms. Sholly Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.
For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares' 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Hoyos Consulting, providing high-speed business internet, data center, co-location, and network consulting. Proud to have grown through referrals and proud to support the shared values of WORT Community Radio. HoyosConsulting.com.
It's 7 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Stay tuned. Perpetual Notion Machine's coming up next.
Folklore Village presents A Lash Ensemble on Friday, March 28th at 7 p.m. A Lash Ensemble comes to us from the Republic of Tuva, which sits at the southern edge of Siberia, with Mongolia to the south. Over the centuries, Tuva has been part of Chinese and Mongolian empires and shares many cultural ties with Mongolia. All members of A Lash were trained in traditional Tuvan music since childhood, first learning from their families and later becoming students of master throat singers. Musicians are inspired by the music of extended family generations of Tuva and Central Asia. At the same time, they are influenced by such Western artists as Sun Ra and Jimi Hendrix. More information is available at folklorevillage.org. Folklore Village presents the Tuvan throat singing of A Lash Ensemble on Friday, March 28th at 7 p.m. at Folklore Village, 3210 County Road BB, just outside of Dodgeville. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Welcome once again to the Perpetual Notion Machine.